Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast and Week 3 of our series we call Deliberate Practice. And joining me is our co-host, Andy Ryland. Andy, great to have you here.
Good to be here again this week, Coach.
So, Andy, Week 1, we focused on early season psychology, trying to manufacture those situations that we might not have been able to face during camp, and you know, talked about sudden change. We talked about all the different dynamics that can happen over the course of the game or course of the season and how you prepare your players on that psychological and emotional level for those things when they come, and really prepare the coaches as well. And then we focused on training away penalties. Early season usually brings on a lot of penalties. I know my Browns here this past week had 18, which was embarrassing. But hey, I'm sure Freddie Kitchens is out there helping those guys get better. He talked about, you know, in the framework of it, just like we did, that some of those things are technique problems, and that's something you and I address. So Week 3 brings us to the idea of preparing for certain situations, and I don't mean situational football like third down red zone, those types of things, but preparing our players in situations rather than framing it as, you know, we might call them drills, to the player, very kind of focused, like there's not as many distractors, there's not as much environment. So we're looking at that concept where we create something that feels more like the game day situations that, you know, essentially we're finding ways to simulate everything that we might see there. So I'll let you kick this off with that idea that you had on how do you do that on the defensive side of the ball, and we were looking at just the situation of maybe having your corner who might not have done a great job this past week containing, and what you could do to give him that picture, create that picture that he's going to see over and over again over the course of the game.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And when we say situations, I think, again, you hit it. It's not situational football. It's what are the situations that happen within the play? Or what are the situations that happen pre-snap that we need to prepare for? And oftentimes as coaches, when we say, hey, we need to go back and we need to teach this better, we start to strip down a lot of the information that was available in the play. And sometimes that's great in a teaching setting. But again, if we go by the idea that at some point our players know what they're supposed to do, it's the execution within chaos, within the environment that let us down, then we have to think about how can we create situations. And this doesn't always have to be within team. I think we're using this term pretty broadly, but we're going to create a situation that has multiple information sources, multiple variables that can go different ways to create something that's more similar to what he's going to go up against. So having a conversation with a coach this week, and you know, they said they'd played pretty well, and he was telling a story about a corner who had lost contain. He was in a compression situation, and he was, you know, compressing in towards the ball, and he turned his shoulders. He didn't swoop. He didn't scallop. He didn't compress, whatever your team calls it, and he got beat outside. And he came to the sideline, and he instantly knew what he had done, and he should have stayed square, and he should have swooped and all that good stuff. But, you know, what let us down on game day? He knew what he was supposed to do. He's trained it before. And so coach was talking about, hey, you know, we may need a little bit of work on this. And your original thought might have been, and I'm sure plenty of coaches would do this, where they'd put a situation where, you know, you kind of get a crack replace or something like that. So the corner's coming up. He's going to be your contain player, and we're going to have a running back inside out. And that inside out running back is, you know, going to press right at him, and he has to keep contain and work it. Well, that's showing us that he knows he's supposed to keep contain, and he's going to take the line. But when we examine the play a little deeper, there was maybe we'll call it some confounding variables or some new information that made this player's job a little harder. So he had the safety working to beat the crack and fill in inside, you know, when you have your linebacker and your defensive end chasing from inside out. And oftentimes, I hope coaches can envision this, one of those two players, the linebacker, the defensive end, actually kind of gets in behind the runner and is chasing from, you know, behind. So we have this half pursuit side of the drill, And then you have your kind of two-man fracture, two-man leverage side of the drill with your corner and your safety, and then your defensive end and your linebacker are in these chase positions. And what happened to the corner, really, it was information overload where there was all these people converging on the ball. And yes, he was supposed to keep contained, but he's starting to think and look about, you know, who's he leveraging with, who's he vicing with. And that's actually kind of what gave him the paralysis by analysis. That's what led him to turn in and try to fit with a guy who was coming and not quite there, and where's the safety. So when we recreate the drill, what the coach ended up doing is using three players. He had a safety deep kind of aligned on the hash. He had a corner wide out, you know, like on the boundary. And then even with the runner, but positioned about 5 yards inside, was a chaser. So now we're creating this fractured, you know, kind of simulated two-man vice with a pursuit player chasing it in from behind that the players are now having to work with and around. So now not only are we tracking, but the inside-out runner, we're looking on our compression, but we're also having to feel these chasers. You know, do we get a big banana line from our pursuit player and he ends up chasing from directly behind? Does he take a good line and he's kind of near hip pressing inside out? What's his relation to the ball carrier? Is he close enough that I can actually use him, or is he so far away that I have to completely forget he's there and just worry about my pursuit angle? And then the coach took it a step further and actually would give each player a number, and he would call the defensive players' numbers during the course of the drill, meaning he would release them at different times. So sometimes the corner would go first, then the chaser, then the safety. Sometimes the safety would go first, then the corner, then the chaser. So their timing and their levels was always split up. But I just thought it was a really good example of a coach trying to recreate the situation and recreate the multiple information sources that were there on the play, instead of stripping it down to a point that it was just, hey, compress this guy and keep him inside. Well, yes, that's ultimately what let him down. But the play and the information and sources are so much richer on game day that I really think we're probably best served to try to create within our drills more situational realism, or at least more options for both the defender and the attacker, so that we create that open dynamic nature. And that got us thinking about some of the stuff that we've seen coming up this week, and looking at, are we creating the right drills, or are we creating the right situations to test our players and prepare for the week?
Andy, I was talking to a coach this weekend as well. It was actually while I was at the Browns game. He texted me and said, do you have any drills for open field tackling when the quarterback runs up the middle after dropping back? And, you know, I told him at the time, hey, I'm at the Browns game. I'll get back to you on this. So we're getting back to you right now, Paul. I apologize. But I think we're looking at that same situation, because we could do a million open field tackling drills, but what can we create for, it's, you know, most likely, who are those guys defending that? Well, that's the linebackers, right? And probably your guys who are inside the box. How can we create those situations for them that feel like it's exactly like it is in the game? Because it's easy to say, oh, I'll drop back and then come up and break down and make this open field tackle. But we have all the other input of guys running routes either behind us or in front of us or outside in or inside out that can move you maybe away from that, distract you for a moment, not allow you to necessarily track right away when that guy starts releasing the pocket. So just thinking that through, and I didn't mention this one to you before we got going, Andy, but how would you troubleshoot that situation and help coach create a drill or a situation to address exactly that?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's the information or the job before tracking the quarterback that can get the linebackers hung up. So if we're using a traditional two-man box, whether it's, you know, 3-4, 4-3, we're going to have a two-man box, and they're dropping out to number twos, and they're going to have to react to number two. So number two has obviously both the in and the out cut and the vertical stem, and your player is going to have to move and react to that. So what I would probably do is I'd take our two linebackers, and, you know, maybe to make it simple, you put a cone out there, but I would put a receiver on the cone. And as a linebacker is dropped to number two, you know, you put the cone in where their normal drop would be. Maybe it's middle of the field if you're in some sort of Tampa or two, and, you know, maybe it's a traditional curl or get under the number two receiver if you're in quarters or three deep coverage. But as the linebacker is dropping, have the receiver release inside or outside so that you're forcing the linebacker to process at least one piece of information before he can react to the quarterback. So I take my number two drop. I see two run in the dig. I try to robot under the dig. I'm going to stay inside and underneath, force the ball up over me. And as I'm working inside, staying underneath that route, all of a sudden, then I have to release to the quarterback. And what happens is oftentimes the player who's nearest the quarterback release or to the side of the quarterback release, he gets caught up with the route. So if we were in a situation where the right linebacker is now working underneath the dig, but the left linebacker is free, the left linebacker is going to break on the ball quicker. Now the left linebacker is in front of the right linebacker. So now how do we work our two-man vice from that situation? So keeping the drill relatively open, not overcoaching it, letting it sort out, means both players are going to have to react to an initial stimulus, and then they're going to read the quarterback's break, and they're going to read it at different times, meaning they're on different levels, on different angles, and different paths, and they have to fit in the open field. And then the other thing that I don't think gets trained enough generally in football is the backtrackers. So I might actually think about throwing in some defensive linemen on this drill and have them, you know, execute a pass rush or do some sort of upfield action and then have them backtrack towards the quarterback. Because as we work on our two-man vice for linebackers and secondary players on a quarterback scramble, we also have to start to think that we can use the players that are backtracking. So if one of our defensive line players gets a good read and starts to backtrack quickly, he's actually in the play. So as we maybe feather our leverage or work to establish a leverage on an angle, you know, we can push him towards a backtrack player. And so we don't know, again, which one of our four defensive linemen is going to get a quick read. In theory, hey, our inside guys are going to be there, but what if our inside guys get upfield and the defensive end gets stonewalled? Now he's the first to backtrack. So, you know, throw a couple backtrackers in there, have them execute something upfield so they have an initial key, an initial read, an initial process. Then we're trying to four-man vice, two from a pass drop and two from an upfield rush, to work back and converge on the play. I think that openness and we're trying to replicate the angles that it'll happen at, meaning two coming from downhill and two coming from backtrack, but not overcoaching it and making it a perfect square and making them react and move to something first, will give you that situation where I'm replicating the situation of the game day, which is execute job one, process information, see something else happen, you know, have to hit the abort button on my first job, right? And all of a sudden get back into my new job and then find new angles, new partners, new leverages, and new vices. So I think that four-player vice drill, go starting off in opposite directions, splitting out from the circle, i.e. upfield and pass drop, and then working back into the center of whatever our drill space is to vice the quarterback is going to be huge. And then all of our tracking drills and all of our open field drills, I keep banging this drum. But if it's not 100% fully competitive, and I don't mean contact, but I mean if you're not telling your quarterback in this situation or your scout team runners in your basic tracking drills, if you're not telling them to try to win and try to be as evasive as possible and actually get away and score, then your guys are not going to go at the speed and have to take the appropriate angles that are going to match up on game day. So full speed, live action, competitive tag drills are a great way to make sure your guys are actually taking the correct line. You know, when guys start getting close and everyone just blows the whistle, oftentimes those little intricacies of the final angle get lost, and that leads to big plays.
I love it, Andy. And that kind of stuff can be trained in 5 or 10 minutes, and your players start to get the feel. They start to get the vision for what that looks like. Your backtrack guys, for example, I mean, you never really hear anybody talking about coming at and making a tackle or, you know, again, it's about the tracking. So you don't have to make this a full contact period either. It's really about understanding that situation and getting back to the ball, because we usually create the situation where that one player is 100% responsible for making the tackle, when in reality, it very rarely works out that way. You have a win as that linebacker if you can get him to run parallel for just two steps to try to evade you, because if that backtracker is doing his job and going the full play, he's there to make the tackle. And I think it starts to create that feel for your players. We talk about it all the time. We talk about it all the time about going, you know, for the full play to the whistle or whatever. But now to really give them the visual cues to create those situations, which they probably don't get a heck of a lot in practice, right? That scout team quarterback is, you know, getting through the line for a couple steps and that guy comes and tags off on him, and we didn't have that tracking. So now we create that drill, and I think of the use of this, especially if you have a guy who you know is a threat with his legs and you worry about, man, we don't want this guy on the scramble or we don't want him running. Well, now put the drill in this week. It's not all about just going out and doing the tackling circuit. Oh, well, we're working the open field tackle because we have to work against this kind of guy this week. But now when we talk about this kind of a drill that you just created or just kind of a situation, we're really working what it looks like or is going to look like, or at least a simulation of it. It's not going to be as fast probably, but we start to see those things like they would develop on game day.
And I think that's the key. It's, you know, open field tackle has become a brand name for a drill, but it's really a concept. And can we create situationally the open field tackles we most expect to make? So whether that's a safety running the alley based on your defense, or whether that's going to be, you know, this scramble drill because we've scouted the film and we know that, hey, number 12 is going to be a problem if he breaks the pocket. We got to be prepared for it. You can, you know, take your normal, hey, we want to make sure we work on open field tackling this week, but make it more applicable. And I think that's the whole concept of situations versus drills. What situations are our guys going to be in? We're going to have underneath defenders trying to close down. We're going to have defensive linemen backtracking. Does this make a good pursuit / tracking drill? Does this make a good open field tackle drill for us based on what we're expecting this week, or maybe what we didn't do well last week and we want to kind of, you know, create some drills that we can use as fix mechanisms, especially early in the week? You know, it's pretty common to try to fix what we didn't do well and then get more game specific to the game plan as we progress.
Andy, the other thing we talked about, and it's not necessarily in the same vein as this, but working things against the defensive line that is going to shift or stem late. And you had mentioned a quote or something going around from Don Brown talking about exactly that.
Yeah, the late move seemed to be popular on social media this week and kind of stemming the front late. And like a lot of things, I think, you know, when Don Brown says something, or when things are starting to go viral, right, people are going to pick it up. And there's a lot of coaches that have been doing it for ages, and now some guys are going to dip their toe in it. And so it's probably something we're going to see more of. And it's that same situation where, are we creating good situations to prepare our players for the late shift and the late move of the defensive front? So what's very common to see is, you know, in our indie drills, maybe we're in our trash can drills or whatever we're going to call it, you know, we're going to shift the front and we're going to go through the communication. And that's great to check that everyone knows what to do. And I'm not saying not to do that. You want to make sure that the information base is there first. But is that creating the situation that those guys are going to be prepared for, which is on a true late stem, on a true move call by the defensive line? It may be in, you know, alignment with the snap count to the point that full communication doesn't have time to happen between all five guys or six guys, you know, if you have a tight end up there, to make sure that it's been verbalized. But is the group thought there? Is the information processing there? Is the idea that our rules are going to take us there still going to be solid, and are we going to be able to execute? So, you know, we were talking about a two-eye shifts into a three technique. We're assuming our combos are going to change at this point. What if we don't have time to say it? You know, what are we going to do in that situation? Are we going to play what was called as far as the checks, the original check at the line? I would assume we'd want to make the preferred combo block. But if we don't have time to verbalize it, can our guys execute it? And it brought me back to an idea where when we were out at University of Washington this offseason, you know, they talked about one of the benefits of home field advantage is how loud it is. And they count on that as a defense. And so they do periods where they're silent periods and the defensive backs only communicate via hand signals because they know on game day they're not going to always be able to have verbal communication. And that unlocks a whole new form of thing, which is the nonverbal communication that our players have, the butt taps, the hand signals, the checks that we do across the field between linebackers and safeties, between quarterbacks and running backs on which way the protection or the coverage is and all those kind of things. And can we execute those in late second, last minutes, or are we preparing for ourselves that's always verbal communication, knowing the game will create situations in which nonverbal communication is needed or implied changes are needed? And I think you had talked about with your offensive line group as well that you were big on making sure that our group learning and the implied changes were understood to the point that it could be executed without verbals if needed. Obviously, verbals are the gold standard, but we want to be able to adjust and adapt if the game, you know, makes it that way.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted our guys to understand early on, we want you to communicate. We want you to be correct in your communication because it shows us that you're getting that understanding. But eventually, what I wanted them to understand about their line calls was essentially they were a security blanket because all of you have eyes. All of you understand this. And so as it changes, you should be able to understand that this is what it would be with or without the call to your buddy. So there is that aspect of being able to practice that too and utilize what you said, those silent practices that, you know, have a period for 5 minutes where you go against the move. And it could be an individual. It could be, you know, in a pod or half line or whatever it might be where those guys are moving and those guys have to adjust without making the calls. From a strategy standpoint, I'd say there's a couple things you can do to handle that. Number one, go on quick count, right? Get up and go. Have your guys make their calls very quickly, get up and go on a quick count. Number two is look at what are your most friendly schemes for that. For us, it was our stretch play. Like if we had teams who would move on us, we felt most comfortable going ahead with the way we would run our stretch as opposed to the way we would run our inside zone. And there were some, you know, variations there. They were both really based on a lot of Alex Gibb stuff, but our guys could go ahead and take their stretch steps and feel a lot more comfortable in doing that than some of the way the combos would work out with the inside zone. So for us, that would be something for those late moves. We would handle it a little bit with those strategies as well. But again, eventually, I mean, doesn't mean like you guys took us out of our outside zone because you're stemming late. No, we just understand that these are the things we need to see. And when it becomes this, this is what our reaction is with or without that call. The call, again, is essentially that communication that lets everybody know we're on the same page. But if you get to that shared mental model that everybody understands this is what we're doing, we're not robots out here, the move, late move of the defense doesn't automatically throw us into a tailspin. We utilize our rules, we utilize our eyes, and we get to where we need to be anyway. So how do you do it, though? Again, it's getting into practice. Again, this doesn't have to be a heavy physical period. It certainly could be something repped out with Go Army Edge in a simulation room. I like to do that with my guys at our one college I was at with. We were in a racquetball court. We did it a lot for our pass protection, but it certainly would work for, you know, run calls as well. And you could utilize those kinds of things where there's late stems or there's, you know, you see a lot of simulated blitzers and guys up on a line, the double mug stuff, all of that stuff where a guy drops out or whatever it might be, that this gives you the opportunity again to get to that shared mental model because you have those reps over and over again without the communication and let the airs happen. You know, don't be afraid of not being 100% in practice. Just make sure that you give the opportunity for learning. So you might not have that communication in the play, but after that play, don't tell your guys what they did right or wrong. Let them tell you what they saw and help get them to the right answer if they can't get there on their own.
Yeah, there's something incredibly powerful too about the players especially the guys with the right mentality, you know, who do it the right way, but having those good conversations. So if a late move and a call doesn't get missed or does get missed, you know, if your center guard and tackle on that side have a quick chat about, hey, we got to boom, boom, boom. Hey, if this happens, we want to do that. You know, that's the kind of the stickiest, most deep form of learning when they start working on it themselves. And that's a proud moment for a coach, right? When that happens and they can self-adjust and talk through it. So I love you talking about, you know, giving them the space to kind of work it out or asking the questions of what should happen. And, you know, nobody likes the old war stories, as people call them. But, you know, I think back to some of the guys that I played with, you know, they were in my recruiting class that I spent all 5 years with. And now that I think back about it, there was plenty of times on the field where we communicated without using like the technical playbook calls. You know, you just say, hey, DT, DT. And he goes, yep, I see it. And that would be it, you know, because we had got to the point there was a shared mental model. We may check with each other, but sometimes the communication between a guard and a tackle can just be something as simple as there's a late stem and he says, I see it, and we feel good about it. And so I think we have to be comfortable with the shared mental model. Again, I love that term, and get our guys used to that. But it goes back to situations, right? In practice, are we creating situations for our guys to train that? You know, we can talk about it. We can walk through it. We can do it on trash cans. We can make sure everybody knows the rules. But situationally, have we created an environment where our players can really explore that, learn that, and get better at that? So whether it is a silent period, again, whether it's a moving period where you're going to work with your scout team, or maybe in a goods on goods pod period, you're going to ask the defensive players to move the front late on you. You know, you can create that situation in a variety of ways. And oftentimes it doesn't always have to be the dedicated way. You know, I'm sure if you ask one of your better defensive linemen during pods or half line, if he could stem a couple fronts for you, he'd just have fun with it and he'd end up doing it to your linemen, and they get some great reps at it just naturally in the form of practice by exploring that environment and making sure their shared mental model is up to par.
Right. And you have to realize as this is going on in the course of the game that you are going to adjust to it. Even if you don't want to go on the quick count, even if it's not, you know, maybe go to a scheme that's a little bit better for it, they're only going to move a certain number of ways. It's not like they have 20 stems drawn up that are going to vary a bunch. It's going to be a small variation, like you said, from a 2i to a 3. Maybe the linebacker moves from a 30 to a 20. Small sets of things that you have to deal with. But you can deal with that in practice, get them ready for it, get their eyes ready for it. And mentally, again, going back to getting them to have that shared mental model. Andy, as you were talking about that, I got caught up in a video as I was looking at some things this past week. And it was the old Landry shift. So you got to think back to the Dallas Cowboys under Tom Landry, where the offensive line would come up to the line of scrimmage and they would have their hands on their knees and on, you know, whatever part of their cadence it was, they would come up and stand straight up and then get down into a three-point stance. And, you know, I remember that growing up all the time. I mean, it was signature. What I was reminded of was why they were really doing it is because they would change the back set, you know, and you're talking under center days there, some T sets, split backs, that kind of stuff. So as the line standing up, they would change the back set very quickly, get down and run the play. And I, you know, it just, again, now you're putting that stressor on the defense of a really quick shift like that. I don't know if that will ever come back into popularity to use something like that. But, you know, just thinking back to it, I thought that was very innovative, especially at that time on how do you disguise what you're doing in the backfield.
No, and I think the current Cowboys this week obviously showed a lot of shifts in motions. People are attributing that to the Boise State influence, and they've been known to do that. But defensively, yeah, shifts in motions become a big thing, and especially teams that have, you know, tendencies. Maybe this early in the year, they haven't established tendency breakers, so people are really looking at things. But, you know, I think of short motion by the H-back or short motion by an A-gap if you're playing a flex bone kind of Navy triple team, where those short motions often turn into lead plays. And you know, you're thinking about, okay, a short motion from an H-back into a lead play, or a short motion from an A-back into a lead play. Is our defense going to have time to get out all the checks or all the words? And is it worth it for people on the sideline to be yelling, watch the read? Or is it those simple communications, those nonverbal sometimes between maybe the overhang in the linebacker on that side, or the front side linebacker and the play side linebacker? Maybe you're going to play a squeeze and scrape technique versus the option where you want your defensive end crashing off the edge. But if he gets short motion, he's probably not going to crash it, because you're going to fill that with your inside linebacker to your overhang player, whatever it is, how you have it drawn up. You know, can we work through those communication rules in nonverbal situations? And I think it becomes incredibly important, and it's something that we have to make sure our guys have reps of, and that they're getting experiences in throughout the course of the year. And sometimes it's okay to throw some things in, I believe, that aren't, you know, quite game plan specific or what our opponent does. But how are we going to treat the short motion? I mean, there's legendary stories, I guess, at this point, right, about guys preparing for the triple option 6 months in advance and working it, you know, a little bit every day in spring practice, just because, you know, Army's on your schedule this week or this season, and you know that's going to be an interesting game. So how can we layer some unique learnings? And I think it helps get football IQ. It helps teach mastery of the system, and it helps teach that shared mental model, which might be more valuable, in my estimation, than one more rep of the specific scheme you're going to see this week.
Yeah, I know I mentioned this to you beforehand. We were talking a little bit about option. Is we had one option team on our schedule when we would play them. I loved just watching the defensive practice film and the way they changed their practice for that particular week in order to get the simulations they need. And they ran two versions. They would do their team period, but they also did two versions of a team period. One was with no football at all, so that guys had to, you know, they were a responsibility team. Guys had to play their responsibility and not get caught up looking for the football. And then the other was with every potential ball carrier with a football, and, you know, everybody essentially having to go and make the play on the guy. And again, I think it's practicing it. It's getting it, that mindset of what you need to do when you face those situations. And again, simulating it in the best way possible. And I love those two ideas for what our guys would do on the defensive side of the ball to prepare that week.
100%. And I think what you're trying to do in that situation goes back to the theme of today's episode, which is situation over drill, or in this case, situation over team period, even, because everyone knows how difficult it is to recreate an option offense if you are not an option offense. So how we recreate that, we're going to put the stress on every player of having to deal with every threat by using no balls or everyone has a football. But that's a great way to ensure that situationally guys are processing lots of information and being able to find their role and be accountable to the playbook and to, you know, which gap is responsible for which responsibility on traditional defensive football versus the option, and make sure our guys understand those roles and responsibilities. And you see things similar sometimes in the passing game where, you know, how are we going to work on these particular passing concepts? And we don't have, you know, a great scout team quarterback, or we don't have enough quarterbacks. And so, you know, you're starting to do your half field stuff and you're doing two ball stuff, especially if you're in man principles where you're not, you know, kind of old school breaking on a ball, but we can try to hug the routes and squeeze the routes and take things away. Well, you know, why can't we play with two quarterbacks and two balls and play two halves of the field, but actually do it at the same time in our 7-on-7 or in our defensive skeleton work? There's all sorts of creative ways that goes back to the idea. I think we've talked about it in episode one of how can we create stressors to test our players' skills? It's kind of skill at the speed of sport. So we can work all our techniques and work all our communications, but can we do it at the speed of a game? And as much as we'd love to have practices and guys, you know, rave about the intensity and the sharpness of the practice, we all know it's hard to create game day environments. So sometimes unique challenges like putting chasers and pursuit players into the play to provide more eyewash and more information, or having five footballs or no footballs, or asking our best linemen to do something like stem and move and work late, asking our players to work in a silent period. That's a way to create some unique stressors that are going to build our players' general abilities as football athletes that I think just carries over to game day so much. And I go back to the point you made earlier. It's okay to have some mistakes during these what we'll call learning periods where we're trying to stress skills and create unique situations and challenge them. Are there times where we want things to be sharp and perfect? Probably. But there's also a time for us to really work on challenging ourselves and our team to be the best they can be. And that might be silent, that might be with crowd noise, or it could be with five footballs. But I love the idea.
Well, Andy, it is all about, again, being intentional with what we do with our time on the practice field. That's the idea behind this whole series. It's one that I really enjoy talking about because I'm a guy who loved practice. I loved to be able to go out there and get our guys ready by looking at things a little bit differently, not necessarily straying away from the fundamentals and the things we do, but looking at those situations. And I love what we've been able to put together here so far early in the season, and I look forward to talking more with you on this series and more deliberate practice.
No doubt. I appreciate you having me on again. To the listeners, again, good luck this week and can't wait to speak again next week.
And if you do have any questions, as we had this past week, a couple guys reached out to us. So again, Andy is at USA Football MT. I am at Coach K Grabowski. Feel free to message us on Twitter. And follow our Twitter for coaches at FBDEVCoach, as well as check out our systems for blocking, defeating blocks, and tackling, our advanced shoulder tackling system, as well as our free shoulder tackling system at footballdevelopment.com.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.